sure incremental works is working really well with privacy and cyber. I'm not sure incremental is actually doing what it needs to do. I actually think that we need to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, there needs to be a shift here. We need to do it now. And everyone's going to have to take a leap at the same time. And while it's awkward, while it's painful, because everyone likes doing things the way that they've always done them. And, you know, there's that old adage, well, if it's not broken, you know, why fix it? But I actually think
it is broken, right?
It is. And, you know, just because we haven't had a data breach doesn't mean that it's not broken. It's just that we haven't had a data breach yet, but it's coming.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a fantastic conversation with Nicole Stevenson, partner at IIS Partners, a prominent privacy consultancy in Australia, where she leads privacy strategy and services. Longtime listeners will remember that Nicole was on the podcast way back in episode 69 in 2018, that long ago. And again, on our COVID catch-up series, which we did on YouTube in 2020. Now, in this episode, Nicole and I discuss what's changed in the privacy landscape in the last few years, for better and for worse, including data breaches and the review of Australia's Privacy Act. Nicole reminds us of the essential principle of nothing about me without me, stressing the imperative to engage and involve the community in co-design solutions. We explore the vital role of public servants in keeping the needs of the community as a focus and touch on the crossover between information security and privacy. Nicole and I then discuss the pros and cons of privacy laws and regulations, and Nicole advocates for a shift away from incremental change in order to keep pace with the speed of technological advances. We finish our chat talking about the emerging trend of the intersection of privacy and AI, the potential for smart city and privacy standards to be combined, and why we need to rethink the term responsible AI. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Nicole. How are you today?
Hello. It's so good to be here. It's been ages since we last caught up.
I know. We're going to have to plan a coffee date, I reckon.
We're not too far from each other, are we really? Just down the range for you?
That's it. Just up the road, down the road, somewhere. Anyway.
You know, last time I drove to your neck of the woods, my car engine overheated.
Going up?
Going down the range.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And no one wanted to help me or pick me up just because it's such an awkward location. Yeah. Not a super good day.
No. Well, today is going to be better than that. So let's jump straight in. And you've been on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. We're just working out when it was. I felt like it wasn't that long ago, but it was. The first official episode was number 69, which was in 2018. And then we had a catch up, which I actually called Privacy and Wine with Nicole Stevenson. And we had a little catch up during COVID, which was really nice. But the naughty cat walking all over the keyboard at the time. But that one you can find on YouTube, but episode 69, we'll put all the links for all of it in the show notes as well. But anyway, I'm excited to have you back on the pod. So much has changed, but then also so little has changed in some other aspects. So really excited to dive into that. But let's not keep the audience waiting and tell us about you. So tell us about your background and what you are passionate about.
Sure. So I am a privacy professional, and unlike a number of people who go through lots of different, perhaps, career paths during their time working, I haven't. I've stayed on the privacy trajectory since graduating university in 1998. And here I am still working in this field and loving it. And I think part of it is because privacy doesn't look the same in terms of what it means from a public policy perspective, and or even what it means in terms of digital and data and the way information moves through society and between organizations and governments, it's all very different. And so because there's always change, change is sort of as good as a holiday, right? Instead of having to take a career break or change career focus, just stay in privacy and wait for things to move, wait for things to evolve. And there's always something more to learn and something new to do.
Yeah, no. And I think it has changed quite significantly, even in the last 5 years, but then since 1998, that's a significant change. So, well, I want to dive into some of the changes that you've seen, and obviously working in the smart city space and more things coming online, more data becoming available. We're using data in different ways. We're giving away data, we're retaining data, all these types of things. But let's go to smart, we'll go broad first. And what is a smart community to you?
So often when we talk about smart, especially in sort of the cities or communities context, right, we're talking about leveraging data and technology to make life smarter, cleaner, faster, more equitable, like sort of all those things, right? All the public benefit sort of statements that we use to justify decision-making, right, about, leveraging technology and data. But I also think a smart community is about finding ways to serve your community that actually solves a problem for the community and makes life better for those who are in it. So from a local government perspective, it's about the delivery of services, and it's about ensuring that the community is satisfied with the delivery of those services and feels that they can continue to trust their government, right? Those are really important aspects. But I think it's also important to remember that not all things that are smart are tech driven. And I just want to call out an example. I was visiting the greater Sydney area recently and came across a township that had been developed. And I'll share the details in the speaking notes for you because it's worth having a look at. So I had the opportunity to attend this township that's close by to Robertson, right? It's a community within a community, is probably a good way of putting it, or a development project. And what they were looking at as from, a design perspective was to be smart. But smart wasn't necessarily about leveraging technology. It was about ensuring that the community that was living in that space felt that they were getting the best out of the township that they were living in, that they felt safe and secure, that they had access to services. And some of the issues for them were things like around traffic management, about how do we slow the traffic down in our streets so that kids can ride their scooters and people can go for walks and, take their dogs out without, having the hoons coming down at 70 kilometers an hour down the street. So that was an issue. Another issue was, how do we prevent things like vandalism in our back laneways? So in this particular township, they had garages that were, lining alleyways. So instead of having your garage facing the street, which is sort of from a community perspective, maybe not that aesthetically pleasing, they decided to put the garages at the back. Well, how do we prevent crime from happening, in spaces that we're not looking at every day? So I think these were important topics. And do you know that both of these problems were not solved by technology, and they were not solved with data? They were solved with some consultation with the community and a little bit of clever thinking about how they might design the township to overcome particular obstacles. And this really resonated with me because as a privacy professional, I often say, is rolling out a new technology the solution to the problem, or are you just looking for a problem to fit the technology? And so in the case of this township, the traffic management problem was solved by, instead of having four-way intersections, right, where you might have a four-way stop or a set of traffic lights or even a roundabout, they caused people to slow down by having the intersection staggered so that in order to turn into the street, people had to be careful about turning, given that, there's a sort of a free flow of traffic coming. Likewise, that free flow of traffic can see that there's a whole bunch of give way signs, to their left and to their right. And that causes people naturally to be more cautious. So instead of driving 70 kilometers an hour down that street, people are driving 50, which is much more sensible. And then to address the issue of, you know, vandalism or burglary through backyard laneways, what they created were these Fonzie flats, which are, I don't know if you've heard of a Fonzie flat, but it sort of harkens back to the old, there's a sitcom called Happy Days that played when I was a kid. And in Happy Days, one of the characters called Fonzie lived over the garages in the back laneway in his neighborhood, right? So he had an apartment that was over a garage. And by virtue of having these one bedroom apartments over these garages on people's blocks, where they could rent the apartment out kind of like a granny flat, or it was considered a single dwelling on its own, you have all this passive surveillance, right? Because there are people living above the back laneway. And when I think about a smart community, I think that's really smart. Mm-hmm. I think instead of having CCTV cameras up or people with fancy alarm systems, having individuals that come and go through the back laneway and have their balcony facing that direction, that actually solves a problem without involving the personal information of anyone and without needing to leverage new technologies. Mm-hmm. So
I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was really great.
I really like that example because it uses that kind of human-centered, or whatever we want to call it, approach, and using the human smarts within mm-hmm. the community. Because I also, like with smart communities, we talk about technology and data, but also mm-hmm. new ways of thinking, I think, and new mm-hmm. ways of approaching things. And I also think then from a data perspective, you know, doing that approach, you then can use the data to show the effects. Yeah. Like, so then it's like not, it's a combination of all of those things together, which I really love.
Yeah, I love that too. And I also like, I mean, whether it's to do with digital and data, whether it's to do with technology, or whether it's just to do with sort of smart, innovative thinking within the community, I like the turn of phrase, nothing about me without me. And in our communities, I think that's really important. It's that, you know, those who are living in the community are actually the best people to tell decision makers what's going on in the community, what their needs are, what the focus ought to be. And if information about them is going to be used or leveraged to solve problems in the community, make life better, more mobile, et cetera, involving them in that process, hearing from them is vital because they become part of the solution then, right? And own the outcomes as the community, as opposed to that kind of more paternalistic way of managing local government, which, you know, that sort of now we know what's best for you. That doesn't always wash with the community. And I see that regularly in my work is that, you know, often people are happy for their government, whichever layer it is, to make decisions on their behalf, but they like to feel that they're part of that and to not, you know, sort of be told what's best for them, but to actually have communicated that first.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's about bringing those needs in, bringing the community in, so they actually feel like they are not just being engaged for the sake of engagement and ticking a box, because it won't get them involved, but it's actually that they're in there, they're part of it, that co-design piece, but also that at the end of the day, the government has to make some kind of decision. It may not suit absolutely everybody, but if they can see where it's being brought in and, you know, the analysis that's been done or whatever you want to call it, then I think you get more empowered citizens because they're a more empowered community because they want to actually contribute because they know that it will make a difference. So I think, it is really, really important. And part of why, like in the smart community space, the community part is, you know, the number one, the mm-hmm. key component. And whether that's a community within a community or, you know, an entire city or, you know, a group or something like that, really understanding what the community needs are, and they'll shift and change as well. So a regular dialogue and a regular kind of involvement is really needed. But first we need the community to understand what it is that, you know, they're trying to get involved in, right? I think, once we do that, and that speaking the language, the language of the community then really helps.
Yeah, I think too, continuing to have my privacy hat on here, the idea that people are trading information about themselves, you know, say in relation to their experience, in relation to their needs, in relation to perhaps their abilities or disabilities or, you know, other factors that affect how they live in their community. When they trade that information with their government, right, their local government, they're doing so with an expectation that something positive will come out of that trade. And I think that this is the key. It's that that relationship, in order for it to stay positive, in order for the for something positive to come out of the trade, is that there has to be that deep respect for the individual that's at the heart of the decision-making that we're doing in the first place. And if I were a local government decision maker, or even the, you know, the folks responding to public policy issues at various different levels of government, I would want that to be sort of my North Star, as opposed to, you know, how do we get best value for money? How do we solve key service delivery problems? I think really focusing on community and community expectations is the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I think that's something that maybe we lose sight of sometimes when we are trying to get, you know, the value for money or the this or the that or the project. You know, we just focus on delivering the outcomes for the project. But those outcomes should then serve the community. Like, that's why we exist, public servants. When we think about this service to the public, when we're talking about government, but it's also a very hard job. And
yeah, it is.
There's lots of, it is complex. I mean, if it was easy, then we wouldn't be having this conversation because all the problems would be solved. Now, I'm really keen to talk about some of the things that have changed since we last had this chat on the podcast, which was 2020, which is obviously a really weird time. It was in May 2020. So we're both in lockdown. Well, I know we were drinking wine. Who knows what time it was? So what's happened recently? Well, I mean, there's been data breaches. We've all talked about data breaches.
Oh, yeah.
There's been all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
There's a ton to unpack because what came out of the pandemic was this shift in how we do things. And I think I foreshadowed that in our call, is that all of a sudden we were seeing that everything was happening via QR code, you know, of some description. And for some reason, whether it was for COVID safe check-ins or for, you know, if you were allowed out of lockdown, you were going to your, you know, your restaurant, but you weren't able to deal with a waiter. You had to order via a QR code, you know, for sort of safe delivery, those sorts of things, right? Safe food delivery. And how this was actually making accessible more and more and more data of the community in terms, you know, not just in terms of how, you know, how we're spending, but in how we're living and where we're shopping and, you know, all of these different things, right? So, but a factor there was that small business had this incredible opportunity that came out of COVID, which was, hey, look, we can be involved with our community on a level that these larger businesses can't. You know, we can provide, you know, delivery of food or delivery of services or goods and serve our community locally in a way that they need right now. And we can leverage these online technologies to do that. That is absolutely fantastic. We saw a growth for small business but many small businesses still did find themselves in major strife, right? But there was an opportunity there with all things digital and things that were data enabled, and that was wonderful. But what comes with that is the cost of those small businesses not necessarily having the infrastructure behind them to be able to deal with that kind of data and to be able to deal with it responsibly over time. So, you know, in the short term, it was about, look, you know, making the goods that somebody needs right now available for delivery. But in the long term, you have all of this information and what do you do with it? How do you store it? And how long do you store it? You know, those kinds of questions were coming up.
I was just going to add, I remember us talking about it and I'd forgotten about it, but remember in the early days when you could go to a restaurant or whatever, but you had to write your name down, your phone number and address and all this kind of stuff.
Mm.
But then the next person would then also see all of that information of mine, which, yeah, just going to that, small business, again, just being underprepared for this because it was unprecedented, right? But mm-hmm. actually being able to have the systems behind them to support the data collection and the methodology mm-hmm. and having privacy as a default layer that from the very beginning and all those type of things, it was huge.
Yeah, and we sort of saw growth there. Like to your point, there are businesses that serve other small businesses, right? So what we saw was a growth in sort of your online customer management systems, right? We saw a growth in this area, you know, your cloud-based accounting services, all of that. That's really actually quite phenomenal and quite wonderful. And I'm a big proponent for small business and startups, and I want to see them be successful. I also want to see them, though, you know, use the guardrails that are there at their disposal to make good decisions about what they do with the information about you and about me once they have it, even if there's not a law in place requiring them to do so, right? So that's one thing that I saw change, you know, during the time post our last wine o'clock that we enjoyed. And then the other thing two other things have happened. The first is that we had this spate of data breaches, and I think they're going to continue, that affected millions of Australians. In fact, we had three data breaches in a row, right? We had Optus, we had Medibank, and we had Latitude Financial, all happening quick succession. And then we also had a whole bunch of other data breaches that were not really reported on to the same degree. But I would venture to say that the bulk of Australians were affected by at least one of those three data breaches. And most Australians that were affected by one were probably impacted by another. And this means that personal information about us is now in a place that is, you know, potentially, you know, nervous or scary for some of us. And, you know, lots of measures have had to be taken by members of the community to lock down their details. And also government has been required to do some sort of reparative work, right? So where things like passports or driver's licenses were compromised. So there's that. So we've had this ramp up of data breaches and a different increased information security focus. And then thirdly, we've had finally, after, you know, two odd years of review, we have finally had some traction in the space of our Privacy Act review at the federal government level. And that's actually a pretty awesome trifecta, right? To think, look, just in the time that we spoke, we have had an upsurge in small businesses taking on personal information, you know, as part of their regular day-to-day activities. We've had data breach and an increased information security climate. And now we have some traction at the federal government level in terms of our Privacy Act review. That's some big change in a short amount of time. For people like me, it's really wonderful and really exciting. I think for folks that operate at a small business level, even a local government level, where they deal with small businesses and suppliers, you know, as part of their supply chain or their vendor groups, what's happening right now is probably a bit confounding, maybe a little bit nervous, and deserves some, I think, some important and dedicated thinking.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's lots happening and can be quite overwhelming about what path to take, because there's multiple different paths to take to go forward. But then also thinking about deploying new technologies and gathering new ways of collecting data and different data and making better decisions. And, you know, if we had certain data, we could make better decisions this way. But then putting that layer of the top, well, if that data then got into the wrong hands, then what would need to happen? And that risk kind of based approach as well. And also thinking about, the cybersecurity element, which is different to the privacy element too. But when we have now that we're all in a full kind of supply chain, like as in even if it's, say, Medibank, for example, like the stolen credentials, and then, you know, they could get in and they could do all these things, and then they're selling that on the dark web, and then all these kind of things as well. But then it's actually not just about them. It's like, well, what if their supplier then got hacked? Or which has been the case in other, I was reading one of them, I can't remember which one it was now, but it was actually there was a LinkedIn data breach. And then through that, people got the credentials to then
hack Dropbox, I think. And then, you know, so it's like this whole supply chain, and that's where the security hygiene, which is, you know, not the same, but links to the privacy elements of data breaches of small business, but also individuals from the human perspective, is really, really important. And I think it's something that is going to get, and, you know, we're not talking about future trends, but it has to be something that we see more and more coming in as a, you know, something that everyone's talking about and doing something about as well.
Yeah. And look, to your point about security and privacy not being the same thing, you're right. They're not. Information security is about ensuring the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data from an organizational perspective and securing data and systems, right? But it is concerned with privacy where the data is also personal information. Then you look at sort of the complementary discipline of privacy, and privacy is about making sure, you know, amongst other things, that personal information from the time it is ingested into the organization or the government until the time that it's deleted or securely destroyed, that it is kept safe through that process, right? And that reasonable steps are taken to ensure that that occurs. I'm actually seeing this. It's actually a really wonderful move where privacy and security are not really in silos anymore. They're actually interlinked and incredibly complementary. And we actually saw this when you look at the outcomes of the Privacy Act review that's been underway for some time that I just spoke about. If you look at that through the other lens that we're looking at things through in terms of Australian public policy, which is around information security or cybersecurity, and you will have seen a lot of work happening in that space. Many of the outcomes for the Privacy Act review link back to what's happening in that cybersecurity space in terms of, you know, Australian national security, security of critical infrastructure, and those types of topics. And that's really relevant for our communities. And you almost can't take one without the other anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also think the more I think about personal data and how much we release it, like our digital footprint, essentially. So, and how all of that's kind of linked as well. So it's like, even if, you know, I don't know, they get into something that doesn't have my personal data, but I've just logged into some website or whatever, but I use that same password across all of my things, then it becomes an issue of then the first kind of breach might not be a privacy thing, but then you know that this all kind of links together as well. And so many different, the way that we're all connected, but also thinking about, say, from if an IoT, so an Internet of Things thing device got hacked, that's just the first, you know, that's the attack vector that they get in. Then they get into the network, which then that's where you get the private information, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this whole, I agree, I think it has to be. And also cybersecurity, we talk a lot about just being technical, like the tech, you know, the coders, the hackers doing, you know, but human factors is such a huge, huge part of that. And, you know, being able to manipulate somebody, and you've got more people now in that space that aren't necessarily coders, but they're social engineers, where they are able to, and the good guys, hopefully, to act in the bad way or to simulate that bad way, so then you can then have a better response at the end of the day. And, you know, you've got penetration testers, that there's a combination of like physical things that they do and all those kind of things. But I just think then the privacy has to be in there from the very beginning, because otherwise, what are we actually trying to protect? And obviously we're trying to protect a whole bunch of things, but when we bring it back to the human perspective, that element is so important.
Yeah, look, I think it's really important for trust. So if we're saying to our communities, it's okay, you know, we've got this covered, you know, whatever you share with us so that we can deliver your services or your benefits, it's okay, it's secure. If we're saying that to the community, we really need to be in a position to put our money where our mouth is and prove it. So, you know, we're increasingly seeing privacy regulators now saying, all right, well, you say that personal information is secure through its life cycle. Show me how. Show me what are those, technical steps or administrative steps or physical steps you are taking to make it so. And I quite like that. And as part of the Privacy Act review, one of the recommendations that the government did accept is that our updated privacy law will include detail about what reasonable steps to secure personal information means in practice. I think this is going to be really useful for, you know, our decision makers from a local government perspective, but then also the vendors and the other folks within the supply chain that service them. I think this is really going to be key.
Yeah, I think the recommendations or the actions are really important there, because then, you know, you don't have to be a cybersecurity expert to know, but also you can be a bit more informed if you do then have to get somebody in to help you do that as well. Like you just said there, like that whole supply chain, it's not just about, you know, big companies like Medibank getting hacked. It's about smaller businesses, because they can then be used to do something else, you know, to move sideways and things like that. Yeah, and I think the more that cities are collecting data as well is also really important to keep like up to date with what we can and can't do, but also then asking the question, just because we can, should we? Which I think the Privacy Act will get more and more, like, you know, we'll have more controls or more, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you've got the ethics and the privacy, right? Which, you know, are not the same thing, but, you know, you can think of them as kind of, you know, very related, obviously.
I think it's about granularity there, Zoe. Yeah. Like, not just, I mean, there's a tendency to be a bit tokenistic, right, in terms of how we make our decisions, and that, you know, yes, of course, you know, we've got privacy covered, or yes, of course, we've got information security covered. But from that trust perspective and that ethics perspective, that, you know, should we, even though we can, that, you know, those kinds of conversations, being able to have a defensible argument for how we're deciding to solve problems within our communities and whether we're going to use technology or data to do that, it's almost more than a compliance thing now. I mean, although we're going to see some good changes, you know, afoot with the Privacy Act review, I actually think we have a much more savvy community that's coming out of this pandemic period, right? Where people have learned a lot, and maybe a lot more than they thought they would, around data practice and what is good information practice versus just sort of middling or not useful at all sort of information practice, and demanding better of our local governments. One of the areas that I still see. So, you know, early on in our talk, you sort of foreshadowed that a lot has changed in privacy, which it has, but also not a whole lot has changed. This is actually really true. I look at our cities that are, you know, looking to some really big things coming up, right? I mean, even our the Olympics in Brisbane coming up, right? That's not that far away. Where we have cities that are being supported to enable technology and these different data initiatives through city deals and other sort of arrangements, we need to be really careful that they actually have the privacy and cybersecurity programs in place before they're going and doing these initiatives, before they're rolling out these technologies and ingesting all of that data. Otherwise, it's pretty risky, right? So from a strategic risk management perspective alone, never mind privacy and cyber as sort of, you know, detail areas, it's not safe. And I'm noticing that not a lot has changed in this space. I'm not seeing funding arrangements being tied to having your privacy or your cybersecurity programs in order. I'm not seeing that. What I'm seeing is that funding arrangements are tied to what are the outcomes we're going to deliver to the community, which is super important. But a major outcome for the community is that their personal information at all stages of its life cycle is kept safe. And this is something that I want to continue to be part of the dialogue in terms of that smart community space and how we give effect to good decision making.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that is really key. And again, it kind of takes that fundamental or kind of seismic shift, but then it will become business as usual, right? Like, and maybe it's not. Is it seismic? Is it a seismic shift, or is it just an incremental, don't know?
Well, I'm not sure incremental works is working really well with privacy. and cyber. I'm not sure incremental is actually doing what it needs to do. I actually think that we need to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, there needs to be a shift here. We need to do it now. And everyone's going to have to take a leap at the same time. And you know, while it's awkward, while it's painful, because everyone likes doing things the way that they've always done them. And, you know, there's that old adage, well, if it's not broken, you know, why fix it? But I actually think
it is broken, right?
It is. And we don't know that you know, just because we haven't had a data breach doesn't mean that it's not broken. It's just that we haven't had a data breach yet.
Yeah.
But it's coming. So I do think some of it is actually a mentality shift. So seismic, yeah, I do. I think it's going to have to be about taking one, you know, one giant leap and saying, okay, it's time to do this now. If our national security objectives, as they've been foreshadowed by the federal government, come to the fore and we end up having a federal cybersecurity law, along with updates to our federal privacy law, we may actually see that seismic shift is decreed, as opposed to being sort of a nice to have or a thing we're encouraging people to do. We may actually see that compliance becomes the driver. My challenge is that when compliance is the driver, we're not actually focusing on the community that we serve. We're focusing on not falling afoul of the law. And those are two different things altogether, right? And focusing on the community that you serve is the thing that engenders trust. Whereas trying not to fall afoul of the law, that's just a risk management thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking, so for example, for sustainability, and then, you know, the regulation came in where local governments then had to measure their emissions and things like that and report, sorry, not necessarily measure obviously, but start reporting on those things. So again, it was a compliance thing. But it forced people to think differently. One, it's just a data project, which then they went, oh, our data house isn't in order. But more so just, do we actually need a compliance thing to get the thinking shifted so then we have a more sustainable outcome in the future? But yes, but on the other side, well, we should want sustainability. We've got our planet, we've got to look after it, all those types of things. And you've got kind of those two things that hopefully then you end up in the right outcome at the end. But you might need, in privacy potentially, because not everyone, local government obviously want to serve the community, but it might be more difficult to know how or get leadership to invest. Whereas if it's a compliance thing, then the investment has to come with it, right? The resources come with it. So I think it's a bit of a,
It's like a bit of a both. It's a tiny bit of chicken and egg.
Yeah.
I think it is. And like, if we look beyond Australia for a moment, and we look to sort of other places around the world, right? I look at, you know, there's some quite neat work happening in the Middle East in Saudi Arabia around smart cities and smart communities. And there's, you know, huge leveraging of technology and data. And I'm really interested to see how the privacy angle is dealt with in that context. I mean, there's some talk about allowing people to monetize their own personal information for the use of their cities and, you know, their smart precincts, et cetera. And there's been a lot of talk in privacy circles about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So the people who think it's a good thing say, well, look, people have choice. They have agency over what happens to their personal information. And if they choose to allow it to be used, they get a financial kickback for that. So that's great. The other camp says, well, it's not really agency at all if you can't afford the alternative, right? So there are some folks who will not be able to afford to say no, and to say, no, you may not use my personal information in this way. No amount of money could make me share this type of personal information with you. There are people who won't be able to afford to do that. So they sort of become the privacy underclass, and they become, you know, almost disenfranchised in a way, right? It's this terrible feedback loop that comes with making choices that aren't really choices at all. And this is a really interesting thing that's happening in other parts of the world where we're looking at, well, can we ask the community to sell their personal information? Do we make it sort of a free market thing as opposed to a compliance thing? So that's really interesting. And I'm watching this one closely because it's, you know, privacy professionals are divided here. You know, some think it's good and it's great and it's a way of innovating the privacy problem. And others think, well, actually, no, it just exacerbates the privacy problem and it creates divisions in our community and greater, more yawning gap between our community and their governments. And to your point about being in the public service, the point about cities is that they are to serve the community. And one of the areas that we serve our community is through good information practice and, you know, strong privacy and cybersecurity controls. So, I mean, you could probably hear in, you know, in terms of what I'm saying, how I lean here, that probably I'm less in favor of monetizing personal data because I don't see how that can work long term. And also there's still someone at the helm, right? There's still someone in control somewhere of all of that data, including then the financial stuff. So
yeah. Yeah, there's a really interesting Black Mirror episode that does.
I love how we go right to Black Mirror.
Yeah. It just, I love watching Black Mirror. It freaks me out, but also I go, it gets me really thinking really critically about some of this technology because some of the stuff that they're talking about in Black Mirror is available right now, but we're just not using it in that way. So it's actually that conversation about being more, the human elements of that and having those discussions. Now, I'm just looking at the time. I feel like we could talk for a lot longer, but I want to zoom to the future. I know we've been talking about future trends already, but what are some of the future trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Well, I think one that we are talking about a lot, but I'm not sure if we're talking about it the right way, is that intersection with privacy and artificial intelligence. So we're at the moment, we're talking a lot about the responsible AI. So responsible AI is being talked about the world over and what that means and what that looks like. And I'm not actually sure we're there yet for a couple of reasons, right? AI itself, responsibility is quite a human kind of characteristic, right? The notion of being responsible is quite a human characteristic. And I'm not sure if we want to sort of put that on our AI, right? In terms of an objective or what we expect of the technology. But more broadly, I think that it diffuses responsibility altogether. If we say responsible AI, we're forgetting that we as the creators and the deployers of these technologies, we are responsible for the AI. And how are we going to give effect to that responsibility in a meaningful way for our community? So that's something that I want to see talked about more and differently, even though we're talking about it a lot now. One good call out though is like the New South Wales government has a, you know, an AI decision-making framework that is publicly available that's pretty good in terms of helping to unpack the kinds of issues that might come up for our various layers of government and our cities and even our vendor partners in terms of the development and the deploying of these technologies. This framework offers some guidance and maybe some scaffolding for good decision-making that wasn't previously there or wasn't collated all in one place. So that's something that I do think is great and should be talked about more and considered in the city's context. So that's one area, I guess, future vision goggles on that I think we've started to do, and there's certainly so much more. And then the other is that I'm seeing now from a city's perspective that there may actually be an opportunity for some design work, I guess, around frameworks or standards, not just in terms of, you know, smart cities framework or privacy standards like ISO 27701. But how do we combine the two? How do we enmesh the two to ensure that smart cities and how they're defined and how they're intended to be deployed also take account of privacy and how it's defined and how it's intended to be deployed? And could we maybe look at that from an international perspective and see some consistency globally? So that's a fingers crossed future vision one. I'm not sure if that could ever happen, but I would love for it to be so.
Me too. I think that would be great. And also just providing that clarity and talking about bringing all that information together in the example you gave is such a huge step, which seems so like a small step. Why isn't all this information together? But it's such a significant step because then people can actually comprehend, you know, it takes the overwhelm out of trying to find everything because you're never going to, you know, there's too many things out there or whatever. Bringing that together and having that information is really important. And then being able to action on that is really key as well. But I wanted to go back to the responsible for AI. I think that reframe is brilliant, and it has to be something we continue to talk about in the future. Because I think when we say, I hadn't really thought about this, but yeah, we were putting this human element onto the AI, like we're inherently trying to remove our accountability or hand it over to the AI. And it's just like, well, no, that's wrong, actually. Because if we think of it as a separate thing that's not created by humans, then we are on a collision path, right? So I think, reframing that really small, responsible for the tiny little four is so key in how we then shift that thinking so then we can have better discussions, which will lead to better focus and awareness and then lead to much better action as well.
Yeah, I think so. And I think too, on the AI topic, I mean, I love the idea of, look, if privacy can ride on the coattails of AI discussions so that it too is elevated as an important consideration amongst all the many other important considerations, I think that's good. I think that there's an opportunity to leverage discussions around this really, really big piece right now. Like, this is where we're at, right? We're like entering the fifth industrial revolution and everyone's really excited about it, but we still haven't got our act together from the fourth industrial revolution around privacy and cybersecurity. So if these concepts, and e-safety too, by the way, and children's privacy and all of these things now need to ride the coattails feel of, you know, the most interesting topic. And if that's AI, then so be it. But we definitely need to make it there. We need to have those discussions in a meaningful way. We need to think about our framing so that we're focused on the community that we serve, our job as public servants or those who support public servants, as opposed to focusing just on the shiny new tech.
Yep, I agree. So many good, amazing things in this conversations or threads in this, threads in this conversation. I don't want it to end, but we're going to have to go about our day on this Saturday. So let's finish off with where to next for smart communities.
I actually think it's a little bit of a back to the future moment for our smart communities. So, you know, much like in the movie Back to the Future, you know, traveling back in time, unearthed ideas and paradigms that, you know, might have been a bit older, but they're still pretty good. Different, you know, ways of thinking that were before that we've kind of forgotten as we've taken this different digital and data trajectory. I think we need to do that here. I think we need to focus on the problems at hand and not whether there's a technology at hand to service the problem initially, but, you know, use our critical thinking skills, use the great minds of the people within our communities to decide what is best in this circumstance. You know, can we do something without leveraging digital and data? Can we avoid using technologies? Can we instead just, you know, change our approach? Just like in the township example that I gave you, can we stagger our intersections to slow traffic down as opposed to having traffic management solutions in place, you know, from a technology perspective? And if we can, maybe we should be doing that. I actually think in some ways it would be more cost effective.
Yeah, I think it's like this hierarchy of approaches or like a combination of approaches as we go forward, but really making sure that we seriously consider the human, well, everything should be a human kind of led approach or a human kind of focused approach or life led. I've seen recently around, you know, also including the flora and fauna and our ecosystems and everything like that as well. But really, yeah, not jumping to the, oh, well, we said we were going to build a road, so we're building a road. It's actually, well, what's the purpose? Well, we want to connect to the community. So could it be, you know, a small road with a footpath, a cycleway, and a shared bicycle scheme, and whatever it is. And maybe, you know, looking at those kind of elements as well, really thinking about how we can, yeah, connect the community and not just digitally, but that all those other kind of elements that we love
to each
humans.
Other.
Yeah,
connect
to each
the
other.
Community to each other.
Yeah.
To get the best outcomes for the community. Absolutely. I think that's a great way to finish, actually.
I agree.
A lovely resonant concept.
I love that. Well, just one last question. How can people connect with you?
Well, I am on LinkedIn. So if you look for me, my sort of handle on LinkedIn is Privacy Maven. I also am available through IIS Partners, which is the consultancy firm that I lead the privacy services for. And I'll make sure that those are available for you in the show notes, Zoe.
That would be amazing. Thank you again so much for coming back on the podcast. I always enjoy our conversations. We need to make sure that it's not as far between them next time, for sure.
Next time.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks again for coming on to the pod. I've really enjoyed this.
My absolute pleasure. I can't wait to do it again.
Thanks, Nicole. Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.